The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Thursday, February 9th, 2017, from Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. I was snowed in today. I'm recording from home, trying to get a read on the weather. I consider the old idea that Eskimos have over 50 words for snow. This is so not true. Not only do Eskimos not have over 50 words for snow, they don't even have the word Eskimo. Inuits. Sorry, Inuits, I had to use the word Eskimo to make a larger point. But you know who does have like 150 words for snow? Our shamans, our healers, our meteorologists. In the space of one update from the WCBS weather deck, I heard about a certain nefarious frozen water vapor substrain.
In the end, 10 to 15 inches of snow. It is that heavy, wet snow, sometimes referred to as heart attack snow, because it's so hard to shovel out there. So make sure you keep that in mind. If you got a shovel or if you need your yard shoveled, don't overdo it yourself. Maybe bring some neighborhood kids in to help you out. That's a lot of snow. And again, it's the heavy, wet snow because there's a high water content.
You got your heavy, wet snow. But the thing that jumped out at me like a heart attack was the heart attack snow. And the advice, use neighborhood kids, use them as fodder for this WMD of snow, throw them in the line of fire like the British at Gallipoli. But if you thought heart attack snow was bad, there was also this.
Thunder snow also has been reported out.
The thunder from the exact opposite of down under falls from the sky. Don't let the thunder tear you asunder. And then when the thunder snow subsides, we got the black ice. I hear they're working on roadside improvised explosive device snow, and flesh-eating bacteria snow, and African killer bee snow, and in a joint combination between ICE's Black September and Sam Champion, super predator snow. Also, the Kremlin has this kompromat snow, which is snow that they can hold over your head and dump on you when you're most vulnerable. Here's the thing about snow. It will eventually melt. And melting our hearts in the spiel today is Ted Cruz, with a history of the KKK, and the Trump administration with a math lesson on rounding. So it's sort of an educational spiel. And you don't even need to bring a gun for the Grizzlies. But first, every day he writes the book, so then one day I read it. And then a few days later, we rang him up to discuss it. It's Elvis Costello.
Hi, I'm Chris Gethard, and I'm very excited to tell you about Beautiful Anonymous, a podcast where I talk to random people on the phone. I tweet out a phone number, thousands of people try to call, you talk to one of them, they stay anonymous, I can't hang up, that's all the rules. I never know what's going to happen. We get serious ones. I've talked with meth dealers on their way to prison. I've talked to people who survived mass shootings. Crazy funny ones. I talked to a guy with a goose laugh, somebody who dresses up as a pirate on the weekends. I never know what's going to happen. It's a great show. Subscribe today, Beautiful Anonymous.
If I were to sell you on a memoir with the following elements, you'd probably read it. The writer starts hanging out with the family of Paul McCartney. First, he meets a rambunctious young Stella, and then Linda shows up and sheepishly says, "Sorry about the girls." Spending Christmas with Johnny Cash, locked out of an auditorium with Dylan, or just a lot of instances of excessive drink with Joe Strummer. And then there are sentences like, "It wasn't an overture as much as it was an underpass, and we stayed in a hotel where the doors were kicked in more than they were unlocked." Well, that would be the selling point. What if I told you this memoir also better explains the lyrics of Elvis Costello than anything I've ever read? The explanation is it was written by Elvis Costello, who joins me now on Faithful Music and Disappearing Ink. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Your mom and your dad both had musical roots. Your mom sold music, which was a harder job then than it probably is now. And your dad was a singer in one of the most well-known orchestra, pop orchestras, I guess, in the UK at the time. So my question is, most everyone who heard Beatles music was taken and swept up. But did hearing your dad actually try to learn and unpack Beatles songs, do you think that helped define music to you as this puzzle that needed to be solved?
You know, I think the first record that I remember my dad singing by Lennon and McCartney was 1963. I was, you know, I was only just nine. So I don't think I really had any analytical capacities about music. It's just what I liked. And you tend to you know, you tend to think, oh, what your parents do is great, unless they're telling you to go to bed early and, you know, eat some green vegetable you don't like. You mostly, you know, admire what they do. And it was just commonplace for my dad to be singing in the house. Prior to that, I'd just taken it for granted that there were these stacks of records lying around, and some of the records on the shelf that I knew were my parents' records that they played for pleasure and if friends came over, and these other ones were something to do with work. Just like any dad coming home or mom coming home with a stack of papers from the office or something like that, you know?
That brings me to your mom's profession. She was so well-versed and she worked in Selfridges. So does that give you any insight? What's the right way to be a music nerd, to be like one of those guys who worked in the record store in High Fidelity?
Nerd's one of those unpleasant modern words like meh and blog. All those abbreviations that people use instead of thinking, you know. If you really love music and you don't, you know, I think you probably find the company of people who want to talk about it too. My parents actually met across a record shop counter because my mother got the reputation of being somebody that knew about music that was at that time hard to get hold of. There was no thought of instantaneous access to any record you wanted over the internet. You were lucky if you heard the music you liked on the few radio stations that played it. So even that little bit of knowledge that you could glean from record release listings and a few magazines that wrote about that kind of music, that would be very valuable. And that story is heard over and over again. You know, it's not unique to my folks at all. You know, I think it is sort of more prevalent in port towns, you have to say, because there's a little bit more traffic in, you know, people bringing stuff home from overseas, just like, hey, there's a nice cut of a suit or something. Oh, yeah, that's the one that they wear in New York when people came home from overseas voyages. The same is true of music, you know. And nowadays, we all sort of are tuned in somewhat to the same stations, you know. You obviously have a lot of variations. And when you go to Europe, you hear lots of different threads of music, and the radio there, they nearly always have policies where they play a lot of homegrown music in the original language, so we don't just all sing the one song.
And in the book, you write about how traveling through America, every radio station is playing one part of Stairway to Heaven or another, and then the DJ comes on, and my God, you won't believe it, it's Stairway to Heaven. At least in that regard, the radio and what we have with music availability on the internet now has gotten better.
Theoretically, yes, it should be the richest time. I think the problem is that there's the curation of music, whether it was that guy that you trusted in the record shop. I mean, that's one thing that High Fidelity Court, you know, has coincidentally the same title as one of my songs that was written about 10 years before that book. But, you know, there always that somebody who, you know, it's an elder brother. I didn't have any elder brothers, so it tended to be people that had the record shop. Then it would be maybe one DJ whose voice you listen to, you know, whose opinion about one kind of music or other, or even just their knowledge of it. You didn't even have to take their opinion about it. They played the music, and the music spoke for itself. If you've got everything all available, there's only the mysteries of the algorithm to kind of prioritize anything.
I guess, but you're right. It is the curse of abundance. If I said, what if I gave you every piece of recorded music ever? You might, you know, 20, 30 years ago said, I'll take it. But then it turns out to be this fire hose where all you could do is maybe snatch a snippet here and there. And one of the things that's changed music into song-based as opposed to album-based. And in your memoir, there are so many considerations about where it belongs on the album and what the album is trying to say. And this was the mid-album ballad. How do you think your career, your output would be different if you were working in a time where the song was valued over the album?
I've lived in a couple of different periods, I suppose. And if you've done it for 30, 40 years, as I've done, you're bound to have, there's bound to be different styles, and sometimes you can find yourself in step with them or ahead of them even. Naturally, it's no longer your turn to be a surprising new person anymore, because you're not, you know. You might still be doing something really good, but the element of surprise is obviously eroded after a while. I actually began with the single. You know, I had three singles out before I made an album. So they were individual songs that the label I was on attempted to introduce me to the public with, all of which failed, two of which at least would be songs that are regularly in my repertoire today. So What does that tell you? The songs were more enduring than the medium in which they were carried.
Oh, it's so funny to be seeing you after so long, girl. And with the way you look, I understand that you were not impressed. But I heard you let that little friend of mine take off your party dress.
In the last 6 years, I've returned to the idea that taking the song to the stage is sometimes a more direct, enduring way of making the song vivid to people than putting it on a record, because it isn't my time to be in the forefront of record making. I did that for a little while, and now I'm not doing it, you know, not in the same way. I've been in both times. I think, you know, obviously the evidence of the book suggests that the objects of records and albums have been important to me. And obviously a lot of my musical education, nearly all of my musical education, has been from just sitting and listening to records, often alone, not so much commonly, you know. It was never a great one for parties or dancing. Even though I've made rhythmic music as part of what I do, I was always more concerned with the mood and the personality of the singer, the little quirks of the way they wrote. And I tried to learn, eventually, once I picked up an instrument, I tried to learn by imitation at first. And I think that's the way most people do it first. And it's in the faultiness of your imitation that you end up creating your own style.
Do you think any of your lyrics ever made one of your hits?
I don't think so, no. What do you mean, made them hits?
Well, I'm just thinking, if Pump It Up were, I don't know, changed to Get It On, would that have been a hit?
It would have been hit by Bob Marley, yeah.
Yeah.
So it would have been, I have no idea. It never occurred to me whether that, I don't think primarily hit records, you know, that are mostly where you're talking about things that are on the radio mm-hmm. now. I mean, a hit record, what's a hit record? Is a hit record a song that endures for 30 or 40 years? Then I guess the lyrics could really matter then.
Yeah.
Because people take them to heart. I mean, I don't think anybody would describe the song I wrote with Clive Lang as Shipbuilder as a hit. It was a minor chart hit for Robert White, very minor.
Is it worth it? A new winter coat and shoes for the wife. And a bicycle on the boy's birthday. It's just a rumor that was spread around town by the women and children. Soon we'll be shipbuilding.
And we were sort of excited, the idea that a song about a serious subject like that could creep into the pop charts, you know? The song has certainly endured. There have been several versions of the song recorded, and I sing it to this day. And when you write a song that seems to be linked to current events, and then similar events occur in a later time, the song has a lot more power to move you than it did even when we first wrote it. There, you know, the ideas in the song are the things that have made it endure as much as it's a beautiful melody. I think there that you could say that the endurance of the song had a lot to do with the lyric.
Right.
And many of the others that people sort of seem to respond to when I play them in concert, I think the same would be true. When you talk about hits, I think it's that instant appeal. It usually comes from the rhythm or the melody then. And then latterly, people realize what you're singing about. And quite often you can have a hit and people are still not terribly certain what you're singing about, you know?
There is one last question I have, and one that was unanswered in the 670 pages of Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink.
That seems impossible to imagine.
I have asked you questions about process and theoretical and ethereal. So this one is my last question. It's grammatical, and it's about Oliver's Army. So it's about collective nouns. It says Oliver's Army is here to stay.
I know this question.
Oliver's Army is here to stay. Oliver's Army.
Oliver's Army is here to stay. Oliver's Army are on their way. Now, I know in America, to us, we would say the army is here to stay. But in England, they would say the jury are returning, or Oliver's Army are here to stay. I read what you wrote about Oliver's Army, how you wrote it in Belfast, even the word Oliver. I didn't realize this, but to you, that's like a posh boy's name. But why the is and the are?
Well, no, it was an allusion. You know, they found the origin of the of the professional army in England is that of the is that of Oliver Cromwell's army. It's not, strictly speaking, the same institution, but prior to that, they were armies raised by the Crown. And that was just a reference, a sideways reference. And obviously, Cromwell went on a particularly brutal campaign in Ireland, so yeah, it seemed like an appropriate reference. Other than that, like I said, I mean, that's the sort of connection that somebody like myself with next to no education, you know, not certainly, I didn't go to college or anything like that, or university. So oddly enough, for somebody that likes words a lot, I don't read a tremendous amount of literature. I've read a lot more history and poetry and books about art than I have read many of the great novels that everybody tells you must read. I've been busy listening to Hank Williams. You know, I'm sorry, but it's just that's actually been more moving to me than reading a lot of things that other people tell you are important. I never really considered the only thing I don't believe you'll find I've ever written ain't in one of my songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't use those kind of, you know, the things that people put in. I'll sing it in other people's songs if I'm singing a cover. I don't use certain kinds of whatever you call those words. I don't really analyze the words at all. One of my concerns is, can you sing this? Does that have the meaning? If you're concentrating on what the pronoun is, you're not listening to the story. And maybe that's my failing in not caring about that. You know, never really thought for that matter about it. I know occasionally I'll get caught out when writing for other people. Like I wrote the word baton.
Uh-huh.
In a song recently, and I had to be told that you say it baton in America. And of course, we call it a baton.
Oh. Unless it's Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, that would be a French word.
Right.
That's back when they allowed that kind of thing to enter the American language.
Would we baton down the hatches, I wonder?
Yeah, well, you could do. Yeah.
Elvis Costello, Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink is the name of the memoir, now out in paperback. Thank you, Elvis.
Well, good to speak with
Thank
you.
Thank you. And now the spiel. I always thought politics was an ongoing battle between argument and accomplishment. Seems like there's about 1,000-to-1 ratio, but argument and accomplishment are related. Sometimes the correlation is what it seems to be. That argument gets in the way of accomplishment. With all this bickering and ill will, how can anything get done? And it's not as if ill will does not abound. We know it abounds. And it's not as if achieving policy goals have become easy. But often the relationship isn't that arguments block accomplishment. It's that the structure of the institutions, which in the United States reward obstructionism, block progress, it's such a frustration that all you can do is argue about it. Let's take the great bemoaning of the loss of decorum we heard out of senators yesterday. Elizabeth Warren needed to be shushed because she was mean to poor old Jeff Sessions. As a white Southerner, Jeff Sessions has been made to take a lot of abuse. Major theme from his hearings. Major theme put forth by other white Southerners. An outgrowth of this fight was Ted Cruz's recent comments on Fox, putting the Democratic Party into historical perspective.
And I'll point out, listen, the Democrats are the party of the Ku Klux Klan. You look at the most racist, you look at the people, the Dixiecrats. They were Democrats who imposed segregation, imposed Jim Crow laws, who founded the Klan. The Klan was founded by a great many Democrats, and yet now the Democrats just accuse anyone they disagree with of being a racist. That was a false smear of Jeff Sessions, and I think he's going to make an extraordinary attorney general.
Some parts of that are true. Nathan Bedford Forrest was a Southern general in the Civil War, was a Democratic delegate to the 1868 presidential convention. founded the Klan. Southern Democrats up through, you know, almost the early 80s were segregationists sometimes. Some were in the Klan. The Dixiecrats, that was only the nickname. Their official name was the States' Rights Democratic Party. Then again, the Dixiecrat presidential nominee was Strom Thurmond, who served the last almost 40 years of his life as a Republican senator in fine standing. But of course, it obscures more than it clarifies. But what it really is, for what we're talking about, is an example of fighting words not preventing progress, but resulting from a frustration that there isn't progress. Right? The commonly held belief is that it's this lack of comity that prevents anything from getting done. I would suggest that the lack of institutional functionality causes a lack of comity to arise. Republicans have been obstructing Democrats successfully because the rules allow them to, because so many actors in our system have the power to say no. There was this old Dennis Miller joke about his displeasure in Amtrak with the in case of emergency pull brakes option available on most Amtrak trains. I don't want to go off the tracks at 100 miles an hour because Gus thought he saw a woodchuck. Well, in politics, woodchucks abound, and we've empowered senators and representatives named Gus. Okay, so you might be saying, well, this was all true in the recent past, but now Republicans control all the branches of government. But what have Republicans achieved? Yes, they've okayed all of Trump's cabinet appointments so far, but that usually happens. That's not an achievement. I suggest that doses of sodium pentothal might reveal that with a few of these cabinet choices, Republicans aren't that happy. But okaying the cabinet is just as much about not picking a fight with the executive as it is with not giving the Democrats a win. So what have the Republicans achieved? Like the travel ban order, that wasn't seen by congressional Republicans as an achievement. That was seen by them as a headache. Even if they support the policy, it caused them a headache. Infrastructure, we're still waiting on that. Then you get to the repeal of the ACA. Well, that's where progress has been proving the hardest. It turns out, as much as people don't like the ACA when it's an abstraction, they like it when you threaten to take it away. It's sort of like the wolf and the polar bear. They seem threatening, but when they're threatened, we like them. Senator Jeff Flake explains the phenomenon by saying it's because now, quote, we're firing real bullets. It's a good point. Senator Bob Corker tells the Huffington Post that, quote, he has no idea when an alternative might be drafted. And quote, to be honest, there is not any real discussion taking place right now. Well, maybe not out of Congress, but there is an idea I wanted to tell you about. It was decreed by President Trump in an executive order on his first day. It's a little arcane. So here's how it goes. Under the rules of the ACA, you can't charge old people premiums that are a lot more than young people. The two are tied. If they weren't, insurance companies would jack up the rates on old people because old people do use more services. So there was a rule put in place that said, yeah, you can't charge old people wildly more money than young people, but you can charge them three times more. That's what the law decreed. This kept healthcare relatively affordable for most old people, but it also dragged younger, healthy people along if you charged old people more. Remember, in dollar terms, the increase on the young, though, was only a third. Practical example, raise the premiums on an old person by $600. You got to raise them on a young person by $200. All right. Now, this Trump executive order put forth a different interpretation of three times as much. And they said you can actually charge 3.49 times as much. Why? Because 3.49 rounds down to three. So by three, they say the law meant 3.5. They have so decreed. Now, I'm just thinking this is how that whole spat about the inauguration figures must have worked. The Washington Post reported that the metro system in LA had 570,000 riders during the Trump inauguration. Now, that compared to Obama's 2013 inauguration, there was 782,000 riders. But you know, the 570,000 Trump riders, that does round up to a million. Oh, you don't like rounding? You don't want rounding? Fine. So let's just keep the 782,000 Obama inauguration goers at 782,000. Wait, what was the Trump number again? Right, a million. Okay, Trump had more. Fine. What about Obama's first inauguration, 2009? We're talking now 570,000 for Trump, 1.1 million for Obama. All right, well, we got to round up again. 570,000, that's a million. 1.1 million, that rounds down to a million. So they're tied. But you know, Everyone knows Trump people carpool more than Obama people, and you can fit four or five people in a car, so really Trump's numbers are bigger if they're tied. Also, there's those crowd density shots, but you know, Obama people, they're the takers, right? So they're probably fatter than Trump people. Might not seem it from what we've seen in the crowds, but let's just say it is. All right, even if you don't buy that, it was colder during Obama's inauguration, so all those people had to wear heavier coats. So the density of the crowd just reflects puffier participants, however they got puffy. And when you do round them down, simple math, you will see Trump's inauguration crowd was clearly bigger. You will see that 3.49 equals 3. And oh, by the way, buy Ivanka. Ivanka stuff on sale at Nordstrom's for just $3. It'll be $3.49 when you get to the checkout. And that's it for today's show. I want to tell you, tomorrow, Julia Yaffe will be hosting. She is a great writer. She knows so much about Russia. She writes for The Atlantic, and she has been holding forth on the now twice a week Foreign Policy Editors Roundtable podcast. It is my favorite foreign policy podcast. No one told me to plug it. I just wanted to. I recommend you check it out and check out Julia tomorrow. Chris Berube edits The Gist, and he rounds down to Chris Berube. Mary Wilson also edits The Gist. She rounds down to Marwol. Executive producer of Slate Podcasts, Stephen Daniel Lichtai, rounds down to Steely Dan. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network. That is actually a round down from the original. Andy Bowers, chief content officer, bishop of Rome, vicar of Christ on earth, and all he surveys within the Panoply Network and the Providence Plantations. The Gist, also a round down. The anesthesiologist, because I take away your pain and help you with the backwards counting. Umperu depuru duperu, and thanks for listening.